Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
Something familiar, something peculiar, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Something appealing, something appalling, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Nothing for kings, nothing for crowns. Bring on the lovers, liars, and clowns.
Yes, it's a song you know from A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Comedy Tonight. But the reason we opened this week's podcast with it is because this is all about theater, but theater not from the perspective you typically hear on this show. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Behind the Curtain. This is Paul Lisnick, and I'm not going to be introducing any casts of any current shows going on, our typical kind of routine here, or even anything political. What we are going to talk about is a new book called Ensemble, an oral history of Chicago theater, written by Mark Larson. I actually saw this on my colleague Dean Richards' desk and took a look at it and said, I have got to get that book. So I did that. Mark is an award-winning educator. He's worked at Evanston Township High School, the Field Museum, Lincoln Park Zoo, that all goes together, and National Lewis University. And I'm just so happy that he eventually got in the world of wanting to write this book on the history of Chicago theater, but through the words, it's an oral history, through the words of the people who have lived it. Mark, welcome to the podcast, and thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
So as I read this book, and when I first saw it, I wasn't sure what I was in for, but it is not your narrative. It is the narrative told by all the hundreds of people in theater that you talk to in the history of Chicago theater. So I'm going to start by saying, when people do pick up this book and read it, who love Chicago theater or want to know more about it, would you say that your perspective is in here? Is it based on perhaps the way you edited it and presented what people say? Or would you say, no, it's really just, it is the words of the people who have lived it and I'm observing?
You know, it's not purely either of those. It's somewhere in between. Inevitably, because I edit it and I choose what's in it, there is my perspective, right? I mean, that's unavoidable. But one of the intentions was that as much as possible, this is told in the words and in the voices of the people who live this experience. So that's what I was trying to capture. But again, it's me, it's my interpretation of it, though, because of my editing.
And listen, when people see the front cover of the book, you obviously have included names that some names grab everybody, because who doesn't know David Schwimmer and Jim Belushi and Laurie Metcalf? And then you have some other name, or John Mahoney. And then you have some other names that, you know, maybe you need to be a little bit more into theater to appreciate just a little bit. Regina Taylor, maybe. Even Mary Zimmerman, who's well known. But I think you know what I'm saying. There are those who are really live the theater world and those who just, you know, recognize these famous names. Am I right in assuming, I think I read this, that the book starts like in 1953, I think it starts when your life did, and but actually, your original plan was to start this book later. You didn't think you had to go far back as you needed to, and then Joyce Piven entered the scene.
That's exactly right. I thought, in my naivete at the time, that it would start with Steppenwolf Theater, because so much sprang from that, and so much was inspired by that. But part of that time, in the 70s, I learned that Joyce Piven and her husband Byrne opened something called Piven Theater Workshop up here in Evanston. And so I thought I'd interview her about that. And I picked up her book in the studio with Joyce Piven, and I read the introduction. And there's all this stuff about Playwrights Theater Club in 1953 and working with Ed Asner and Mike Nichols and Elaine May and all those Paul Sills and those folks. And so when I went to talk to her, I thought, well, let's just talk a little bit about that. And it absolutely captivated me. And by the time I left her apartment, we talked for quite a while. When I left her apartment, I thought, I've got to go back to 1953, because that's probably where this movement began.
And by the way, when we say the name Joyce Piven, just for the younger people who might be listening in, they might say, I know that name, Piven. I wonder if they're related.
Yes. her son is Jeremy Piven. And her daughter is Shira Piven, who's a filmmaker and TV director.
So obviously the apples did not fall far from that tree.
No, they grew up with it.
You know, and I've been living in the theater world for a very long time, too. And whenever I speak about it or it comes up, I realize New York will always be New York. It is Broadway. But, Mark, and I'm sure you had this feeling even before you started the book, but it's hard to look at Chicago as a second city to Broadway. I mean, in many ways, maybe I'm biased, maybe you are, but I almost think New York could take some lessons from Chicago as a theater community. It's a theater town. What do you feel about that?
I'm very interested in what you meant by that, actually. What lessons in what way?
Well, what I have in mind is when I think of the number of small theaters or black box theaters or theaters that have grown, like, as you say, the Steppenwolf, the Goodman, that had very humble beginnings, Looking Glass. These very humble beginnings then have come into the kind of the very respected behemoths that they are and so respectful that, and it seems to me when I look at New York, not that they don't have that, but New York has these sort of established theaters, productions come in and out, but as a birthplace of talent, as a birthplace of ensembles, that'd be a good title for a book. I just feel as though Chicago really has written the book, only you wrote it.
I think that's true. But, you know, I'm always trying to check my bias on that, too. I'm a lifelong Chicagoan, and I have not lived in New York, and I have not lived in L.A. I've heard things from people who have done both, lived in both places. But my feeling is, and it's probably very provincial, but my feeling is that there's something quite unique about what's happening here in Chicago that gives rise to incredible creativity. I think there's an ability to take risks here that doesn't exist on either coast. I think there's a selflessness that's here that's unusual, too, that allows companies to help one another, that allows ensembles within a place like Looking Glass to be wanting the others to look good. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think these are unusual aspects. And that's part of the reason the book's even called Ensemble, because it's not just because we have ensembles here, like Looking Glass and Steppenwolf and Black Ensemble Theater. It's because the theater community here tends to operate as a kind of ensemble, too.
And one of the things that struck me, and that part of our conversation almost takes me to the end of your book, because you have a final chapter. I didn't know what it was when I first read the title, which is To Leave or Not to Leave. I didn't know what you were referring to. And then, of course, as we read the words of those whom you spoke to, it was the decisions they had to make. All the various stars who began here in Chicago, the decisions they had to make as to whether they would leave Chicago or not early on in their career. People like, you know, David Schwimmer or Amy Morton, you know, whose careers began locally, and then, of course, we see them there. Why did you end the book with the chapter on To Leave or Not to Leave? Was the whole notion that as we read people's responses, it would give us, sort of propel us for maybe the next chapter in maybe a future book of yours, but maybe just the next chapter of Chicago theater?
It's partly looking, it's more like an epilogue. That's how I looked at it, where I was trying to bring back some of these themes from the beginning. I tried three or four different endings, and each one that I rejected, actually my publisher rejected, were rejected because they were specific to a specific theater company. I had one where one ending was I interviewed Mike Shannon and Guy Vince Waringen and Shira Piven, who were reprising a play they had done when they were kids and nobody knew who they were. And they pulled that cast back together and Shira was directing it. And when you consider what's happened to all three of them in between, I found that really interesting. Well, that was too specific to Red Orchid. You know, otherwise I found it fascinating. Maybe I'll do a, you know, magazine article on it or something, because it's good stuff. But the book is large and it's long, and I was thinking of it not in a grandiose sense, but thinking of it like a symphony. How do you end to something that's that big? And you bring back a lot of the original themes. So that chapter begins with Ed Asner, who talks at the very beginning of the book, and he's talking about, you know what, I couldn't stick around here. I was getting all these good reviews. I'm not making any money here. I wanted to do something, you know. I wanted to do something with my life.
Yeah. And so I get that. That makes a lot of sense to me. And as we look at the theaters you covered, I mean, for example, I'm going to pop into the chapter that dealt with how the theater community dealt with the AIDS crisis. And that was something that struck me in a variety of different ways, not the least of which is to say, you know, yes, there's theater and we got Oklahoma. We, you know, there's a span of all sorts of shows to do. But then when there is a crisis in the world, something going on, priest abuse cases, whatever it is, all of a sudden the theater community seems to address it and deal with it. And you devote a chapter to essentially how the theater community community, which got so strongly hit by the AIDS crisis, dealt with it. And sort of the in that way, sort of the growth of what would be LGBT theater that, that came from it. Why the focus on that issue as opposed to you almost could have picked any political issue and had a chapter go on it?
Well, it became very clear to me that it really hit this community very, very hard. And I do think it helped reshape it in some ways, and in some ways brought it together as a, an artistic community. You're aware of Season of Concern here in
Chicago? Of course, sure.
That was born out of this. And it was very illustrative, I thought, of how this community operates, because we lost Tommy Viscotto, and we lost another actor whose name is escaping me, darn it, J. Pat Miller. And that hit people really hard, and they had a memorial service, and I was told that at that memorial service, somebody stood up and said, "We can't let this happen. We have to help each other," and people started passing checks forward, and then this fund was formed called Season of Concern, which continues to this day. Every time around the holidays, winter holidays, they ask for money after a show, and that's what that's about. So I think it was I thought it was illustrative of what this community is like and how it operates, but I also thought it was had a huge impact on it.
And of course, you also have Broadway Cares in New York, so in many ways, some of the things that happened in Chicago parallel what also goes on in New York. And for that matter, that just sends me to asking you about the Jefferson Awards, because, and you write about that, how those got created, because we all know about the Tony Awards, named for Antoinette Perry, and then Chicago got an idea, we ought to do our own thing, and they were sort of told, yeah, but you ought to pick a Chicagoan tie to that. Talk about how the Joseph Jefferson Awards came around.
This was in a time when things were really just starting to happen here. And one of the big things that was going on was, like at Drury Lane and other theaters, they bring in a star like Rita Moreno or something, and somebody. And the Chicago cast then would assemble, but they didn't get much attention. You know, they would be cast in these shows, but they didn't get much attention. And we were beginning to have our own homegrown stuff. And several people got together and said, you know, we really need to acknowledge what's going on here. And they decided to do their own version of the Tonys. And they did talk to the Tony Committee, and that's where the name came, that the name Jefferson came from, because somebody on the Tony, associated with the Tony, said, you know, choose somebody more Chicagoan. And there was this guy named Jefferson who used to do Rip Van Winkle way, way, way right back. And why don't you use that name? And that's how that came about.
And I know this is the question that's going to frustrate you. It probably does every time you do an interview. But anybody who knows theater reads this book, and then we're looking for certain people, and we are looking for certain theaters. So relevant to our conversation about sort of the AIDS or the growth of LGBTQ issues, we have theaters today like About Face Theater, which you do address and stuff. I saw there wasn't a lot of reference to, say, Bailiwick Theater, which I think put a lot of these issues on the map back in those days of the 80s and the 90s. David Zack kind of taking a critical role. He's still doing his thing over at Pride Films and Plays. But it had to be torturous for you to take, like Bailiwick, take something and just go, you know what, something's got to go, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on certain things.
Two parts to my answer. One is Bailiwick is in there a bit. David Zack is in there.
Oh, yeah. No, and I didn't say, now he's in there. But I'm just talking about in terms of the impact. Go ahead.
But to the larger question, yes, it's absolutely agonizing. There's a lot that we didn't use. And I do have a website where I'm putting some of that supplementary, I think of it now as supplementary material. But it's agonizing to try to make that decision. Plus, you make relationships with people, and you don't want to leave them out, you know? It's like being left out of the yearbook or something. So it was hard. It was hard to make those decisions. Largely, they were made along practical lines. If I was looking at, say, two different companies, and they told sort of the same story, and they, you know, contributed to the notion of what the Chicago theater movement was about in kind of the same ways, one of them had to go, you know. So I tried to make decisions that way.
And clearly, certain theater companies had to make a difference. So, for example, you talked to Michael Weber of the Porchlight Theater, but Porchlight Music Theater, in my memory, was started not by Weber, but by Walter Stearns. And I didn't see Walter Stearns in the book. Did you chat with Walter out of curiosity?
I did not, no. What I was working on, I talked to Michael mostly about his early days at Candlelight.
Right.
The thing that happened with Porchlight and others, because I want to do something with Firebrand, too, but I wanted to do something about large musicals in small spaces. But that's one of those things that sort of got removed as a whole chunk, you know what I mean, when we had to start cutting. So that's what happened with Porchlight. I'm going to do more work on this too. So in this area. So I do think I'm going to be hitting those things at some point.
And of course, you also include the critics. You have Richard Christensen and Chris Jones, and I'm sure their books, and I've read both of those. Chris has written a couple of books, but one which is basically a history of reviews throughout the years. Did those inform you in terms of the work you
Very
needed to do?
So. Very much so. I really loved Chris's collection of reviews. I thought I'd sort of just dive in where my interest was. Say, let's see what they said about True West. I thought it was informing in that way. But I ended up reading it front to back a couple times, just because it kind of tells the story. It really gives the evolution. I thought he did a wonderful job with that.
And I respect him greatly. I once said to him, I had him on radio, and I once said, you know, Chris, you and I truly agree about 95% of the time. And he said, and the other 5%, Paul, you're wrong. So I thought, well, there's probably truth to that. You know, I also imagine that every time you talk to somebody, they gave you 20 more people to talk to. And at some point, did you just kind of hope people would stop? Either no matter what name they gave you, you said, no, I got that. Or were you thankful? Oh, yeah, that's another great five names. Or at some point, did you just go, gosh, enough already? How many hundreds can I talk to?
It was more the people around me, like my wife and my publisher, who were saying, you've got to stop. But for me, it was incredibly addictive. It really was. I was just following my own curiosity. That was a big part of it. And that just became kind of endless. Mm. And you're absolutely right. Every time you talk to somebody, they say, you know who you need to talk to? You have to talk to so-and-so. And then they'll give me contact information, or I'll get in touch with them and put you guys in touch. That just kept going. And when I worked on it for 4.5 years, and during that time, I just chased down some alley, you know, that somebody was saying, you've got to go check this out down this way. And the rich stuff that I'd find there. So I kept thinking, what if I say no to this? Mm. You know, this most recent one. What if I say no to that? Then what? what will I miss? So it was very hard to cut it off.
I would think that anybody you talk to for a project like this, and I know you had that feeling. I know when you first sat down with Andy White from Looking Glass and came up with the idea, Andy was all over it and started a ball rolling for you. I would think, now listen for my sarcasm coming up, okay? I would think that everybody you talk to would definitely want to be part of this book, and I was especially moved by your interaction with David Mamet.
Hmm.
Did my sarcasm read?
Yes, it did.
Talk to me about David Mamet.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it probably needs explanation.
Yeah.
First off, I have to preface it by saying I was stunned by how many people were willing to talk and went out of their way to do it. I got very few people saying no. I never anticipated that. I never anticipated that I'd be talking to Ed Asner or Julia Louis-Dreyfus and some of these people. It just seemed out of reach.
I'm going to drift you for a second. Did Ed Asner use a lot of salty language with you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's amazing.
I just saw him recently, too, when he was in Evanston. We had dinner with some other people. It was actually associated with the Piven Theater Workshop.
I had him on my Politics Tonight TV show, and I had to keep saying, Ed, you cannot swear on TV. Please don't swear.
He's got that character, and he kind of cultivates it.
Absolutely. But anyway, back to David Mamet.
David Mamet. So what I was saying was that it was very, very few people said no outright. There were people who just didn't answer my emails, and I took it as a no after a little while. But very few said no. I kept trying to get to David Mamet and trying to get to him and trying to get to him through friends, and it wasn't going anywhere. And finally, I wrote a letter. on paper and sent it with a stamp to an address I got. And I heard back from his assistant who said, well, David doesn't do interviews anymore, but he will do, he'll answer questions. So send us 10 questions without follow-ups.
That has to be great for an interviewer to not be able to follow up.
Right, right.
It sounds like something for the Mueller report.
Exactly, yes. I found that, especially too, because I found that way of trying to communicate very, very difficult. My style was much more conversational, and one thing leads to another, you know. And to write out 10 questions and get the right questions, and it just wasn't my style at all, and I was really bad at it. And so what I got back from him were pretty curt replies. And without the follow-up, there just wasn't that much I could use. For which I think I fault myself, though, too. It was just not my form.
You know, a couple of the chapters you talk about, one sort of addresses theaters that developed on the north side of the city, another talks about theaters that developed on the south side of the city. Then you have something like the Black Ensemble Theater, which developed on the north side of the city for the purpose of playing and bringing the north side of the city so they understood, you know, African-American and minority issues. When I once interviewed Jackie Taylor, I sort of said, you know, one would expect Black Ensemble to be on the south side. She said, yeah, exactly. That's why I'm not there. They don't need to see this theater. The north side needs to see this theater. Talk about how the different parts of the city sort of reflect who that part of the city is. And is Jackie Taylor unusual in terms of her desire to reach across lines?
I think there's a lot of effort to reach across lines, and it's not always successful. Just last night, I did something, did a conversation at the Green Line Performing Arts Center, which is brand new. It's not even a year old. And it's meant to be a space where it's kind of an incubator for performing arts works. And what was really interesting to me about it was that there were a lot of people who were from the South Side, who were part of the art scene back in the 70s when things were really hopping. There were something like 9 or 10 black companies at that time on the South Side, but we rarely hear about them. And one of the reasons was this reaching across that border, if we think of it as a border, caused some problems. Funding started going to the larger theaters like Victory Gardens and Goodman when the donors wanted more diversity in those theaters. You see what I mean?
Sure.
And so let's get more diversity and let's get a wider audience into your place. But what it ended up happening was that's where the dollars went, as opposed to why aren't you funding the smaller black companies that are struggling and wanting to come up on the South Side? So that, you know, that struggle still continues.
And when you look at the theaters who have grown in amazing ways, and they're almost all at a certain power and level, Steppenwolf and the growth of their capital campaigns, Goodman Theater from their humble beginnings over in the Art Institute, Looking Glass, who found themselves, and I know that's a great story, and I did a 30-minute special on my backstage show on Looking Glass and sitting with Schwimmer and Joey Slotnick and Billy Deck and others, where they first had the opportunity to go into that water tower space, and they weren't going to do it. They're like, we can't do that, whatever. And then Andy White once said to me, he said, what are we, nuts? Of course we're going there. Talk a bit about some of these amazing theaters and Victory Gardens as well, who then seem to find a home, which makes you wonder, why weren't you here 100 years ago? But of course, what it is about those theaters that have given them the incredible growth that they've experienced. And you could toss Writers Theater into that as well, if you want.
You could definitely, Black Ensemble as well.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I actually did a chapter on, I think it's called From the Ground Up. You know, these are companies that started just, you know, some people sitting around the table, like Steppenwolf and Looking Glass, just some people with an idea. And it grew from that into, now we're going to build our own space, which is just astonishing to me, you know?
Yeah.
And Looking Glass is a great example. Though they didn't build their own space, they certainly found a niche in the space that already existed and turned it into a theater. But there's a scene in there with Andy, maybe they shared this with you too, where it was just before they were going to open Race, which was their first show, and they all stood in a circle. These are all these people who had known each other since college, And they have been at something like 21 different homes. You know, they kept finding different spaces to perform. And this was their own space, and it was on Michigan Avenue, for God's sake. And they stood in the circle, and David Catlin and Schwimmer looked at each other, and I don't know if I can say this on your podcast, but they said, they just mouthed the words, what the, how did this happen, you know? And Catlin even says, here was Schwimmer, he'd been doing Friends now for a long time, but even though he had reached that pinnacle, that this could happen to us, that had started so small, I just find that remarkable and interesting. The other thing that happens, though, and this happened with Looking Glass, is they asked themselves, do we really want to do this? We're this scrappy little group that would go from place to place, and then we would suit whatever production we were doing to the space. Who are we going to be? Who are we if we're on the Gold Coast? How does that change us?
Sure.
You know, that I think that's something they really struggled with.
And by the way, I think I missed one, and you did have a chapter on this. We should have mentioned Court Theater as another one of those spaces that truly grew from the ground up. I wanted to get your, and I have to say, I'm a huge supporter of the arts. You can go into so many of the theaters we're talking about, and you'll find something I've named in that theater, whether it's chairs at the Steppenwolf and the Goodman, the Victory Gardens, or whether it's the bar at Black Ensemble Theater. I really believe in supporting our local theater. But I was sort of curious. I remember part of what always propelled me was to think, artists, directors, they're just a starving community. Many are.
Yeah.
But then a couple of years ago, there was an article that appeared in the Sun-Times, and it listed incomes of a variety of key people in the theaters. And I'll be honest, when I read some of those incomes, I'm not going to go disclose them now, but some big names at some of the major theaters, they were, I mean, the income, my jaw dropped. And I thought, I'm donating to this stuff, and they're making a fortune. And I talked about it with some, and the answer came back to me. I want to get your thoughts to it. Look, if you're trying to keep good people, you need to pay them, and that's just what it takes. What's your reaction to the fact that some of these folks make, and I'm talking about $300,000, $350,000, that kind of thing. It's good money.
You know, it's like it's not spread out very evenly is the way it looks, you know, it's especially given what you're just talking about there. The epigraph at the beginning of the book is Amy Morton saying, in Chicago, we knew we weren't going to get rich and we weren't going to get famous, so we just got good. They focused on the work itself. But I think that notion can also get romanticized and abused. And I think that happens to a certain degree. I'm trying to focus in on what it is that you're asking me, to be honest, Paul.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is there is an image that people in the theater community are struggling artists all the time. And the bottom line is in the Chicago theater community, many are not struggling artists. They do very well, and we support it, and I think it's great. And I'm sort of wondering if it's a do people work as hard? Do people sort of go for it when you're really doing well in that instance, as opposed to I'm always trying to get that better role and take that next step up?
You know, I don't know that I can answer that. I'm not inside that part of the world at all. And it's not something that I really talked with them about. What I do know is this, that especially the smaller companies struggle mightily. You know, I follow a lot of them on Facebook just so I can get a peek into, you know, what's going on for them. And it is a major struggle financially for most. I don't think what you're talking about is the norm.
It's not. It was something that struck me. It's a smaller group of theaters, but there's no question about it. And again, I encourage everybody, okay, support these theaters, big, small, and otherwise, because so many really need the help and can use it. They all want to be that next success story.
Right. Right.
By the way, how far does it? We talk about Chicago theater, but you can also look up to, well, Writers Theater takes us up to Glencoe, but Northlight up in Skokie. I mean, does the Chicagoland theater community, as you would end up defining it, have a boundary, or is it expanding?
I think it's quite expanding. Northlight is definitely considered part of Chicago theater. Writers is too. I put that question to Michael Halberstam. He said, absolutely, I feel part of, you know, Chicago. Court obviously is up in Hyde Park, so that, you know, that is within those boundaries. But look at 16th Street Theater in Berwyn. I consider that part of the Chicago theater. I asked Jim Cordy at Paramount up in Aurora, do you feel part of Chicago? He said, absolutely. You know, so if I don't know where you draw the boundary, really.
Yeah, I'm glad we, and I prefer not to, actually. Let's just let it grow.
Right. Just let it grow. Exactly right. I do think they do feel very much a part of the community and contribute to it, too. Like Paramount is always up for Jeff Awards, right?
Absolutely. And I was just out there recently and saw Newsies, and what an incredible, you know, Jim Corti and the work out there. That's a stunning theater. And you're right. That's an hour ride, depending on where you live, out to the Paramount. And then it's a real treasure that you don't want to miss.
Yeah, it's I love going out there. I really do.
If you were going to write a book that focused in depthly on, and I know that you have a project that you want to work on, which is where you might follow sort of the creation of a work of art from beginning to end. If you were going to write, a book about, you know, the creation of various shows, I mean, it's been done with some, like Chorus Line, that take it from the very beginning. There'd be no end to what theater productions you would look at, but you did pick one. You went to August Osage County, which was an amazing, amazing play from Steppenwolf, went to the big screen and all that. But what was it about August Osage County that you said, of the thousands of plays I'm going to give a chapter to, I'm giving it to this?
The book really is based on origin stories and pivot points, because I knew I couldn't tell the entire history of these places unless it was a place like Remains that went away, you know, then it's a shorter history. But I was looking for pivot points as well as origin stories. And August really what seemed to be a pivot point for Steppenwolf. It kind of thrust them into who they are now, I think. And so I grabbed onto that for that reason, aesthetically, because of, you know, how it contributed to my narrative, but also because I got so many of the people who were in it. It's just a practical matter. You know, I was able to talk to so many people, including Tracy, who wrote it. So that's why I wanted to focus on that.
And it was an amazing piece. After having talked to all these people, what is it, do you think, that you look at the ensemble cast or the history of the ensemble at, say, a Steppenwolf, John Malkovich, John Mahoney? Is there anything you could put your finger on to say, this is why certain theaters have filled not just the Chicago theater with such success, but the national scene, the international scene, theater, movies, television? What is it about certain theater companies that lead them to truly break out in every way? Maybe part of it is they get a national Tony from time to time, as so many of these theaters have received, and others where you know, the actors are just as fine. They're so incredible, but it just, they stay in a different world. Do you have any sense of what would explain that?
I'm going to take some guesses, all right? Because I haven't been asked that before. If you look at Steppenwolf, which is kind of the prime example, obviously, that was quite an amassing of talent right from the start, right? I mean, it was just a coming together of major talents.
Sure.
And what they did, though, when you look at the fact that most of them aren't around anymore. Rondi and Lori and Gary and Terry and Jeff, they're not here.
Right.
And when's the last time you saw any of them on the stage? I think one of the things that's really helped Steppenwolf is they evolved. You know, they figured out who am I now, as opposed to how do we retain what we always had? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that reinvention is a big part of it. Plus, they were just able to attract such powerful talent.
But
the others, though,
I would say, but so many times when you think of where these talents came together as an ensemble, it was all their early years. It's before they are who they are.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
They must have seen something in each other. Steppenwolf also, and I am fascinated, and again, I support them as well in so many ways, but it's been fascinating. They had some dips in their history where I can remember some seasons where I'm going, something's slipping here. Something is not working. How much of a theater's, for me anyway, how much of a theater's success is guided by that artistic director? And I'm thinking you gave a chapter to Martha Lavey, so deserving and so sorely missed by the theater community, but it's pretty powerful who's at the helm of the ship, isn't it?
Very much so. And in that chapter, you see just how powerful Martha Lavey's influence was. You know, it's just setting an ethos and sticking to it. And Bruce Norris, I think, credits her with turning it into a playwright's theater, too. When she turned to Bruce Norris, who now is a major and significant writer, but he hadn't really done anything. When she turned to him and said, why don't you write a play, you know, and send it to me. Tracy Letts really wasn't getting much done at the time. He got Nebraska Man done at Steppenwolf. You know, she recognized these talents and nurtured it, and she turned it into a playwright's theater now. Now they've got Tyrell, too, Elvin McRaney. So I think, you know, so that's just one example of what the artistic director does in terms of setting the course for a theater and sticking to it.
And why a Bob Falls is so critical at the helm of a Goodman.
Absolutely. It's another perfect example. You know, he went in there when he left Wisdom Bridge, that little Wisdom Bridge on Howard Street. He said, I'm going to go big. That's my thing. I'm going to go big. And that's what he did.
And of course, you have people like go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, starting with his very first season at the old Goodman.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then I think of people like Fred Adzavino and Theo Ubuque Theater and some of these real charms and crowns in the jewel. And they, of course, moved up to Evanston. So we'll put them in the world of Chicagoland Theater, where you have dinner and watch the show. And again, incredible voices, incredible talent. When you look at, and I'm going to let you, Mark, decide where the level, say, just underneath a Goodman, Steppenwolf, Victory Gardens, Looking Glass is. But of all the theaters you've looked at and studied, and you pretty much know them all right now, who would you say people should say, or that you would say, keep your eye on that one, folks? This one's just about to explode. And I mean in a big way, in a good way.
Wow, you're asking me one?
Oh, you can give me 10. I don't care.
Oh, okay, good. I thought you were going to make me narrow it down.
That'd be too mean.
Somebody came. Ubuque, I think, is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
To do this, you know, that falls into the thing I was talking about earlier about big musical in a very tiny space, and it's its own aesthetic. I find that absolutely fascinating. I think people should really pay attention to that. Firebrand is amazing too, in that little space at the Den. Powerful shows, and they came out strong right out of the gate too with Lizzie, and have done really well ever since then. Ever since, what are they, in their second year?
Yeah.
I just think what they're doing is amazing too. Oobleck, I just saw one of their shows at the Den downstairs. I can't remember the name of it, but Michael Marr wrote it. It's about theater, and it is beautifully done, beautifully written, beautifully directed, and beautifully acted. I think people ought to be paying attention to that as well. Gosh, there's just so many though,
and that's what's beautiful. That's why it had what you did had to be so tough to do.
Yeah, there's so many. And I don't think the rest of the country gets a sense of the scope. I don't know that with Chicagoans. The average Chicagoan has a sense of the scope of what's here. Well, the variety and just the volume.
And that takes me, actually, I'm going to put one more in. I'm going to say Porchlight Music Theater as well, because I know arguably you could put them in that category above, but I just think, man, every time I see a show there and review it, my comments are always, every time I think they can't get better, they do their next production. And just some phenomenal. Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I'll be doing an event with Hollis Resnick and Michael Weber at the Arts Club on October 4th, getting people ready for Sunset Boulevard.
I can't wait for that.
So I hope you come to that event. You might enjoy it. Or take over for me. Just kick me off the stage and go take it. but I do want to ask you, this. I mean, for me as a Chicagoan lifelong, I read this book and I'm home. You know, I mean, I just I don't know every name you've talked to, but I read this book and I feel I'm at home. For people who don't live in Chicago, maybe never been to Chicago, is the purpose of them reading this book? That's why, again, when you see certain names on the front like John Mahoney, you're just going to grab it and want to read it. But is your message to them, hey, if you live in New York or you live elsewhere, you don't know what you're missing in the Chicago theater community, you better get over here?
I think it's part of it. I think it's to spread the news. We did try to position the book as a national story. And that's why the names are on the front for people who aren't in Chicago. I originally was calling it Ensemble Chicago, but my publisher said, let's just call it Ensemble, so that it's more universal. It's partly to say you don't know what you're missing here, but it's also, I've talked to several different universities, and they're interested in it because it does tell the story of where a small company begins and the struggles it goes through and how it gets itself started. And I'm hoping it'll be useful in that way too. instructive for new companies and young people coming, whether it's to Chicago or somewhere else, and just see how it's done. But see, it's almost like watching a documentary as opposed to reading a how-to. That's how I looked at it. Mm-hmm. And I think it could be helpful in that way, too. But I think Chicago's rightfully proud of what they've got here, and I think they want the rest of the country to know it.
Can I ask you one more question you can't answer?
Yeah, sure.
If somebody came to you and said, Mark, I've read your book, I've amazed by all that's going on in Chicago, I'm going to start a theater company here. There's no better place to start it, but I want to fill a niche that Chicago isn't addressing. What is it?
Wow, that's a great question.
I can call you back tomorrow for the answer. Now we've got the pressure of being on the podcast. So you got to give me that. What is there anything Chicago is missing that you'd say, here's what I would want to do if I was starting a theater company?
You know, everything that comes to mind just off the top of my head as I watch the minutes tip guy here. I'd love to see a place that's only about original work. You know, I think a lot of places try that, but they have to sprinkle in other stuff.
So something beyond Victory Gardens?
Victory Gardens doesn't do just original work.
Well, that may be what you're talking about. They sprinkle in other stuff, but I think they mean it to be always original work.
Yeah. So, well, that's what I mean, though.
Yeah.
An idea like that springs to mind, and then, well, wait, we've got one of those. I'll be honest with you. I need to think about that.
That's cool. I didn't really mean it as a trick question because I thought of that question, yeah, I don't know how I would answer it either because anything you're looking for in Chicago, it is here somewhere if you look for it. And if you can't find it, there's an artistic director of a theater company who will say, I'll do that because I want that kind of thing to happen. It's almost as though let's do a show about, you know, Sondheim. Gee, we won't get Sondheim. Well, how about if we get him on video and we'll call it Sondheim by Sondheim, right? I mean, well, there's always a way to make something happen. And by the way, in an almost, you know, when I think of the auditorium theater, that's too something which is, you know, you could argue a bit outside what you were looking at because of the nature of what it is. But, you know, it's part of the playground. It's part of the landscape of where theater will sometimes find a home in that incredible space.
That's absolutely right. It's part of the landscape. You're absolutely right.
Well, the book is called Ensemble, An Oral History of Chicago Theater. I think you listeners can gather both by your excitement and mine that this is just such a needed book. Like I said, when I saw it on Dean Richards' desk, I went, I am totally getting that book, and I want to talk to Mark Larson. And I'm so happy that you were able to. Actually, I just did a book signing out at Evergreen Public Library, and you're coming up there because they mentioned you. While I was there,
and yeah.
I can tell you they're very nice people, and I'll tell you something else. If they have somebody there who's there to question you, like as a, you know, a kind of a host for the day, which they did for me, mm-hmm. They never asked any questions because the audience was so great. We filled an hour and a half of audience questions.
That's wonderful.
They're really into it, and you will find that many of them will have read the book even before you get there. So anyway, it's Ensemble, An Oral History of Chicago Theater, Mark Larson's. Congratulations. This is I know what it's like to finish a book and see it published and see it. And I'll tell you what, you have to be as proud as you can be to see this. And it makes me just basically say, please follow it up. Please do something else because I want more from you.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure to talk to you, Paul. You said at the beginning that you had read it all the way through, and I could tell that you had. I really appreciate that.
There you go. With notes,
really good questions.
Notes and all. Thanks so much. The book is Ensemble. Mark Larson. Thank you, my friend. Appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.